This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
Hey, it's Mark Arla Page, and I want to personally invite you to the Entree Architect Meetup at the AIA National Conference in Boston this June. This special event hosted by Entree Architect and Gable Media is open to all small firm architects, whether you're attending the conference or not. You don't need to be going to the conference. You can just come and hang out with us. Last year, over 100 architects joined us, and we're doing it again. Same energy, same amazing community. Grab your ticket and get all the details at entrearchitect.com/AIA25. AIA25, entrearchitect.com/AIA25. I'd love to see you there. My name is Mark Arla Page, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. My guest today is an internationally renowned architect. His work sits in the intersection of design excellence and ecological responsibility. With over 40 years of experience, Kevin Kennan has led major projects like the Barclays North American headquarters and the Rodin Museum in Seoul. He's a thought leader on sustainable architecture. Kevin is truly inspiring and shaping the future of our built environment. Kevin Kennan, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to our conversation today.
I am looking forward to it as well. Before we jump into a conversation about practice and the future of practice and ecological impacts that our world is feeling, I want to know more about you, Kevin. I want to know your origin story. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to get started?
It's actually kind of a boring story because my father was an architect, and a very passionate architect, and so I grew up in that environment. But one of the things that I liked a lot about my origin was that we traveled a lot, and we lived in South America for a while, and I grew up basically in California and lived in Southern California most of my life until I went to school, came east to school, and pretty much stayed on the East Coast ever since. That's what led me ultimately into architecture. I went to a small liberal arts college and was an English major. I didn't really want to necessarily follow my father's footsteps, but I came to New York. We had a program with my school. It was kind of a semester abroad program, but it was in New York City, and we got to study at a program called the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies. This would be in the late 70s, and it was a crazy place and a very exciting time, and New York was a very different place.
Oh, yeah.
At that time. But for whatever reason, I got the bug there, and it stayed with me ever since.
So when you got to New York City doing that program, was that the end of your education, or was that in the middle of it?
That was actually kind of the beginning of my architecture education. And, you know, when I graduated with my bachelor's, I got offers at many different schools, but I decided at the time to go to Princeton. So I got my architecture degree at Princeton. But essentially, at the same time, I was also working an apprentice at different companies. I started initially working for Kevin Roach in New Haven, and then IMP. And, you know, those in those days, what you did as a young architect was you kind of went and you worked for people whose work you admired, and you kind of did your time and sort of, I guess, what we would call slaved away. But at the time, that was what you did, and that was a kind of focus in your life. I think that's changed a lot now, and perhaps for the better. But anyway, so that's basically how I got interested in architecture and evolved from there.
So you leave architecture school, you work with some pretty high profile architecture firms in New Haven and New York. What was next? What did you do from there?
Well, then I went to Cohn Pedersen Fox, KPF, and was there for 12 years. I became the youngest partner there at the time, design partner. And the thing that changed essentially my whole career in my life, it was 9/11. We lived a few blocks away from the World Trade Center and profoundly affected by that.
Yeah.
And that ultimately, in my involvement, I got very involved in the World Trade Center. And that involvement essentially led me to my own practice, where I've had in one shape or another ever since.
When did you start your own practice?
2002.
So right after 9/11.
Yeah. What happened was my wife and I had gone down to visit the site, I would say maybe 2 weeks after the event. And what we saw there was sort of utter pandemonium, you know, of throngs of people sort of surrounding the site. This is, at this point, it was just a kind of simple barrier around it, a sort of chain link fence. And, you know, if people were literally climbing up the chain link fence, there were people talking souvenirs, the World Trade Center, and it was just a mess. And I understood people's need to sort of try to make sense of it, and that's why they came down. I thought there was probably a more dignified way of doing that. And so I kind of gathered some friends of mine, and we essentially pitched a proposal to the administration. That was the Giuliani administration at the time. And we essentially designed and built, raised the money, designed and built, developed, designed and built the temporary viewing platform, the Ground Zero. And that was an amazing experience for me because I learned a lot about the power of architecture to heal.
Yeah. That is such a great example of an architect experiencing something profound, realizing that you had the skill and the talent to do something about it in your own way, and went out and raised the money, proposed to the city this viewing platform, which became pretty well known at the time. I remember that platform that may have not been done if it wasn't for you, that it may have just continued to be people showing up at the fences and the gates to, you know, try to get a peek of this historic moment.
It was a very interesting process. So we almost came very close a couple of times to not being able to do it at all. And it was originally a lot more ambitious. We had sort of proposed it for different sites. Ultimately, it was a deputy mayor and Giuliani who suggested the one site where we ended up building it. And it turned out to be a really fantastic choice because it was adjacent to St. Paul's Chapel, which is in the northeast quadrant of the World Trade Center complex. And it was remarkable, but this chapel was a place, a sanctuary for a lot of the workers and people who were first responders at the World Trade Center would go for solace and sleep a lot of time. But behind that chapel was this cemetery, and the cemetery contained a whole sort of mini forest of 600-foot tall, 400-year-old elm trees.
Wow. In downtown Manhattan.
In downtown Manhattan. And it was a really very peaceful sort of place that remarkably was untouched by any of the sort of debris from World Trade Center. And so the whole concept of this was to sort of elevate the platform up about 20 feet to allow people to get a sort of view into this. But the effect of that elevation and being adjacent to the trees and I guess the cemetery itself created a very profound effect, quite moving actually, but silent. And that was the most remarkable thing. People would wait in line for blocks and blocks and blocks to get up this platform. And it was all done with very simple materials, plywood and New York scaffolding. And that's ultimately, you know, one of the more brilliant parts about it. It's just we cobbled it together from the stuff you would see in sidewalk sheds.
Right.
Essentially, you know, very New York kind of response in hindsight. But anyway, it was a phenomenal experience. So where architecture could really meet the moment. And I think those types of experiences, and I'm sure other people have had similar experiences, especially in areas which have been damaged by floods or fires, landslides, you know, that architecture, we forget about that sometimes, about some of the other reasons why architecture is important.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about that platform and what it must have taken to accomplish, because building a structure of any type in New York City is difficult. To build a temporary structure has got to be incredibly difficult. To do it in a time where everybody else is so focused on recovery and rebuilding and all of the things that were happening in that time, it took years to rebuild that area. And you're talking weeks after the event. How did you make that happen? Did you have connections with the city to be able to pull something like that off?
Yeah, we had some preliminary connections. It actually started out as a place that we ultimately created another place that was just private for the families to go.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it started, the germ of it. But, you know, I felt strongly there needed to be some place for the public, for the world to somehow understand and see this. But, you know, the story that most people don't know is that not only did we design and build this, but we also raised the money to do that. And that was really probably the more difficult part. A lot of anonymous donors and contributors to that effort. Anyway, so yeah, it had a profound effect on me and completely changed my career after that. And I got very involved in that. And then when it came time, the city had put out a proposal, an RFQ, and to do the design, the master plan for Ground Zero.
Right.
I had put together another group, also all my friends, and we were one of the finalists in that, one of five finalists in that competition. And that was even a better experience in many respects than the first one. But I think the temporary viewing platform is still one of my favorite projects because it was built from just the most humblest of materials, and it had a large direct impact on people's lives.
So did those projects inspire you to decide to start your own firm, or did you already have that sort of in your mind that I wanted to start my own firm and that just became the time where it happened?
I think it was really more the former, you know, that it sort of propelled me in a particular direction. Maybe one I was already headed towards. I had already started a teaching career at that point as well. I had been teaching at Yale. And I think at the time I was teaching at Princeton in the undergraduate program there. So to some degree, I already have maybe a little bit of foot in this, but both the temporary gaming platform and then also the competition to redesign the World Trade Center were extremely important points in my career and really propelled me into my own journey.
So what did the new firm look like when you launched it? And what type of work did you do? And was it just you and a handful of people, or how did the firm start?
Well, actually, yeah, I put together a group of people to work directly with me and in this collaboration. And they sort of stuck around with me, and they became the sort of nucleus of a new practice. And I was fortunate enough to get a lot of work at that time. And we really started to do some very interesting things. We were doing competitions. There were a lot of ideas that grew out of the World Trade Center and how to revitalize downtown and revitalize the city. So I became involved in a number of proposals in that. And all of them, you know, I've done a lot of work in New York City, but that grew into ultimately an international practice where I did work all around the world.
I'm sure that the work that you did at Ground Zero, both for the viewing platform as well as the design and design competition, was an international news story. So the whole world knew that design competition and the people who were presenting at that competition. So you were thrust into the world's spotlight, I'm sure, which probably also helped launch the firm in terms of notoriety and people knowing who you are and the work that you've done. Is that true?
Yeah, to some degree. I guess if there's been some sort of a lodestar in my career, it's building relationships with people and, you know, essentially friendships. You know, a lot of my clients were people I'd already either worked with in the past or people I knew in the industry. And, you know, and I'm a huge believer in collaboration. I think that a lot of architects feel like they have to go their own way and, you know, sort of the brutalist kind of powered work. So the imagery of architects is kind of loners. And that's just not the case for me. And I don't think it's the case for many architects. I think a lot of architects get involved in architecture because they like studio culture and sort of a way to engage with your friends and colleagues collaboratively. And, you know, we don't do this by ourselves.
Right. So it's been a long time since 9/11. How did that firm that you launched coming out of 9/11 evolve into what you're doing today? Because you're doing a lot of work today in a lot of different areas. So how did that story come about?
Well, one of the first projects that I did was with a friend of mine who actually ended up co-developing this project. It's a very interesting building in Tribeca, New York. It's a little bit like, so it was a former industrialized area of the city.
Yeah.
Downtown, just north of where the World Trade Center is. And there was a fantastic building there that was almost a block long. And now these blocks downtown are smaller than the blocks you're used to thinking about in Midtown. But it was a block long. It was on a small little cobblestone, almost alley. And it was the original American Express building back when the American Express was like the Pony Express. And the lower part of the building was where the horses would stay. And then the upper part would be where they would process packages and things like that to deliver all across the Northeast. And so that building had gone through a lot of iterations. The kind of more interesting iteration of that building was it became the Alexander Calder's, the sculptor's, mid-century modern sculptor, famous for doing mobiles and sort of large metal sculptures. That was a studio. Then it became a nightclub. And by the time we were involved with the building, it was hardly recognizable as a building. It had just been plastered over by graffiti. In essence, we took that building, again, former sort of industrial building, and repurposed it into luxury apartments. And then we added two floors to that. That was done in a very sort of modern way, glass, a lot of outdoor decks and landscaping. And that turned out to be a very terrific project and had a host of challenges, but, you know, one that sort of led me on this path to doing and developing a lot of adaptive reuse buildings in the city.
Before we started recording, you had mentioned that you have several companies. So my question is, how do you go from starting one firm to launching several different companies, and why did you do that?
Well, I have a very broad view of what we do. I've never really liked being sort of pinned down, you know, to any part of practice. I think the great thing about architecture, at least from my perspective, is that it does touch a lot of different disciplines. And so I've always advocated a sort of multidisciplinary approach to what I do, regardless of where I do it. And so because of that, I have to sort of funnel my focus into specific areas. Otherwise, it's really difficult for me to manage my own time. So I have a company that does, you know, just architecture. I have another company that I started really at the same time at 2002, which was, I inherited the same program that I'd gone to, the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies. It was founded by Peter Eisenman. He bequeathed it to me just after 9/11. And we repurposed that whole program and just focused on doing education work, particularly around people going to smaller schools that didn't have access to architecture. We essentially developed a program where people can get credit at those smaller undergraduate institutions and come to New York, experience New York. We had housing for them that one of our directors had developed on Roosevelt Island. And, you know, they came and they were essentially an adjunct to the studio. And that we had that program all the way up until the pandemic. And that sort of changed it. And now we're actually in the process of kind of reinventing that again. This time, maybe not so much as an educational endeavor, but really more in terms of publication.
What kind of publication?
So I've always been interested in essentially answering the question of what is the value of architecture? And it's one that I think is something that we've lost sight of. I think our profession has become overly specialized. And that becomes difficult, I think, for some people to understand exactly what it is that we do and what is the value that we bring. And I guess I've always, perhaps it's a romantic view, but I've always been more drawn to the profession for its ability to help reimagine the future. And I think that's something we do best.
Yeah.
And so that's essentially what the publication is about. It's really highlighting, in this case, new talent and new ideas and people who are engaged in that reimagining of the future, which is, I think, of really vital importance right now. We seem to have lost our way. And so that's essentially the kind of ethos that we're trying to frame this initial idea for a new type of publication.
Will that be like a magazine or a book or online?
I think at this point, you know, we're just focused on it making digital, but trying to, again, highlight and almost curate new talent wherever it may be all over the world. A different way to sort of go about approaching architecture, a really much more broader way to do it. And if people can get engaged in architecture and come at it from completely different directions. And I think we should embrace that. I think that's a whole different model than the one I was describing where, you know, you went to architecture school, you did your time, and worked with somebody, you did your time. And that sort of apprenticeship method, I just don't think works anymore. I think people should really branch out early in their career. And, you know, I'd like to think that I can help young practices essentially connect them with work. Frankly, and the way that I was able to help young people essentially develop their portfolios so they could get into the architecture school in my nonprofit, the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies.
Is it still called that?
Yes.
Or is it being rebranded? All right. Because I think people are going to start Googling as we're talking.
Yeah, they should. It's a terrific. In fact, there's a new book that just came out about the Institute, and it's about 600 pages. It's a huge book, actually. It's a good doorstop, but it's got a lot of great documents about the program and its origins back in the late 60s and goes all the way through about the early 80s. And then we restarted it in 2002. But it wasn't the same program. It was really more focused on just education.
I want to dive deeper into practice and the future, your thoughts on the future of practice. But before we do that, I want to hear about some of the other things that you're doing, because you talked about two, and I know that you're doing more than two. I know that listeners are like, I want to know the other things he's doing.
Yeah, sure. Well, so then really post-pandemic, I realized that I was getting more calls to be the first of those, an expert witness in litigation. And so I developed that in an area of standard of care and building the information on them. And that sort of led me to sort of do a smaller company that's just do consulting on different projects. And that's really where I'm brought in to solve problems, which I like to do. And it's not just about design. It's a lot about practice.
Yeah. Is that why you launched that separate from the architecture firm? Because you want to be able to expand beyond just architecture?
Right. Yeah. So I like doing that. I love helping people in whatever way I can. And it can be just in the middle of a home rebuild or remodel or maybe new construction. And, you know, they're having difficulties understanding, you know, why they're getting charged the way they are. Or, you know, maybe they have some doubts about what's going on. And I like to help them sort of guide them through that, because it's a daunting process for people, especially if you're doing it for the first time. And every project, as you know, is unique. There's no template for what we do.
Right.
It's all challenging at every single level. So I like that part of it. And then, you know, I guess because of my early success at co-development, I started a development company. And that's really focused on building wilderness hospitality projects.
Interesting. So you got your hands in a lot of different aspects of the profession, doing lots of things. That's interesting all by itself. I mean, in terms of time, how do you focus on each one of those things and make sure that they all stay successful?
Well, as we know, the challenge in our business is essentially it boils down to getting paid to do things that we like to do. And then also understanding from our client's perspective, how do we frame what we do in terms that they understand what our value is? And I think this is one of the biggest disconnects we have in our profession are both of those things. The biggest killer, I think, and I've certainly experienced the ups and downs of practice, is overhead. You know, so I've now really been focused on distributed practice, but unfortunately, I've been in the business so long, and I know a lot of people at various levels, that I can essentially support younger firms and outsource a lot of the work and try to create a different model for working. So that really helps a lot. And now with agentic AI, essentially the skills that I've developed, I'm a lousy employee. You know, no one will hire me to be an employee. But, you know, I think I'm pretty good at essentially establishing a direction, setting the tone, having those collaborative discussions and proving projects, you know, both with my clients, with our consultants. What I think most people don't understand is that while if you're a design architect like I am, that you're really the kind of point of the spear for a lot of these sort of complex building projects is what I tend to specialize in. And really, a big part of it is not only kind of sort of composing the music, but you're also conducting the orchestra, a sort of a symphony of experts. And that's a skill set that is very difficult to understand and learn unless you've kind of been through it a bunch of times in your career. So that's a synthetic kind of thing. It's not overly specialized, because you really have to be able to be a good listener as much as anything, you know, and understand that the combination of working together is often the best way to achieve superior results.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, RCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at rcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to rcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's rcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. The profession, I feel, is at a turning point, possibly even a tipping point. With AI becoming ubiquitous in everything that we're doing, having AI become agentic, like you said, and the impact of climate and the changes that are happening with the climate, do you feel, and this is my words, not yours, but I want to know if you agree with me, do you feel that the profession is in crisis?
Inflection would be the way that I would look at it. Yeah, it's potential that we're about to just head off a cliff, not just us, but
yeah.
A lot of service professions. But you know, for whatever reason, I think because the early manifestation of AI is in areas, in creative areas of architecture, film, movies, and even to some degree even music, I think. But the profession hasn't adopted some of the, let's say, legal frameworks that exist in other creative professions. You know, we don't have agents, and we should. I think it's good. But it's protected in those, in music and film. And architecture is not protected that way, and I think it's unfortunate. But I do think, though, that the possibility of tapping into our imagination in a creative way and utilizing AI as that sort of tool, I think it's there. And I just think we have to broaden our sort of understanding definition of what it is that we do and the values that we create.
Yeah. You mentioned very early in our conversation about your focus on the value of architects and the value of architecture. What do you think the profession would look like with all of the changes that are happening, with the evolution of the internet, which is a big piece of it as well, because we have an opportunity to use the internet and the communication opportunities that we have to express more about what we do and how we do it on an individual basis, right? Not just the AIA, not just large firms, but every individual architect has an opportunity to tell their story. What does the profession look like in your mind in the short term, you know, 5-10 years from now?
Well, you know, what you're doing is, to me, a really positive example of that, how architects can become better communicators and better storytellers about what you do. It's what's so surprising is that a lot of architects, really successful architects, are very good at telling those stories, because
yes,
what other, you know, profession that you're essentially creating a vision of something that doesn't exist somewhere, in this case, you know, maybe 5 to 6 or 7 years in the future, and convincing people to essentially pay all that money up front, you know, to do that. That's a unique skill set that not many other professions have. And so that's what I really want to advocate here is, you know, for people who've got that kind of imagination and also have a sense that there is a power in being able to tell those stories and tell the stories not simply with images but also with words, and to really break down some of the barriers that we kind of impose on ourselves through jargon, or sometimes a little bit of academic, overly academic sort of language that I think we can reach more people and hopefully help people better understand that architects have an important role to play in our society.
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes it comes down to architects not having the confidence and the courage to use the talents and the skills that they do have. Because, I mean, storytelling, like you said, is inherent in what we do. I mean, it's a huge part of architectural education, right? Is they teach you how to design and they teach you how to think like a designer, but they also require you to tell the story of what you designed and how you designed it in that critique that we all go through with presenting our projects to the studio board. You have to be able to explain what you've done and why you've done it and what you think the future of the impact of what you've done is going to do, right? That's a story. And we've all been trained to do it as architects. But I think many of us, either they don't make the connection, right? They have that skill and that they can use it beyond selling their architecture to push it to the point where, like you're talking about, telling the story of what you do to the world in any way that you can do that, right? Through audio, through video, through writing, through any way that you can get the word out. We all can do it because we've all been trained to do it.
And I think what happens is it's a little bit intimidating for a lot of people.
It is.
You know, the thing that I'm sure you get this all the time is people essentially saying, well, you know, how do you have the sort of courage to go out there and sort of dream up these things that do cost an awful lot of money and involve a great deal of time and effort? And it's a little bit of a leap of faith that you have to make, and you have to believe in your own capabilities, but not just yours, understanding that it takes, in many cases, thousands of people who are involved in some of these projects, that you want to instill in all of them a sense of belonging, a sense of authorship. Frankly, you know, my greatest thrill in doing any project is when I hear, if I go to the job site and I hear the people talking with a sense of pride about what it is that they're doing and what they're working on. I would have that response over anything a client would say to me. It's typically like, oh, it looks just like the rendering. You know, I would much rather have that kind of larger social engagement and understanding that it's a political responsibility as much as anything else, and a social one. So I think we should just embrace that sort of what I call the visionary part of architecture, because I think that in the long run, that's of greater value to our community. And I think the lasting effect that we have on future generations.
I think architects are very much visionaries, right? Because that's why they're drawn to the profession. I think, again, it's the same thing that they have the vision, but they don't communicate it. They have a disconnect between the work that they do on a daily basis and sharing that work with the rest of the world. And you know, the value of architects and the value of architecture, I would say, is probably the number one complaint that architects have, that the world doesn't understand what we do, right? It's what they say all the time. But that's not going to change until we start telling our stories.
That's exactly the point, Mike. And I'm glad you brought that up. We have to stop complaining as a group and take ownership of the narrative and turn that into something, you know, positive. You know, I don't understand how anybody can become an architect and not be fundamentally an optimist, because essentially, how can you have the courage of your convictions without having some sense that the future, you're going to make the future a better place? It's, they're not, you can't sell dystopia. It's, to some degree, even if it sounds a little bit naive, be willing to advocate for a utopia, a better world. And if we don't do it, I don't know who else is going to. And now what's interesting is that we have seen over the past, I would say majority of my career, the trend where everyone in our profession was advocating for specialization. Oh, you know, you have to be a specialist in hospitals, or you have to be a specialist in museums, or specialists in multifamily. And, you know, I've had a career where I've done almost everything, you know, from skyscrapers to bathrooms. And I think if you just approach these sorts of problems and understand that you may not have all the answers, but you certainly know who does, and make sure that you bring those people along in the process. And, you know, don't feel compelled to sort of shuffle them off into the margins, because that's not really the way to succeed.
It sounds to me, from hearing your story and understanding how you got started, that the collaboration is a huge part of your success. I mean, right from the very beginning in doing the observation platform,
yeah,
you talked about assembling a team of friends that you knew that could do the work.
Yeah, it's a little bit just, you know, sort of play acting to some degree, you know, that, oh, let's put on a show. And I've had, fortunately, have had a lot of great success. It's not always successful that way. I mean, sometimes egos do get involved. But for the most part, I think if you approach it with a certain amount of equanimity and a care, you get the best work out of people, and there's plenty of credit to go around. I do understand that to some degree, the media, I guess, you know, likes to make heroes, and sometimes the simplest story is to sort of say someone's a hero and someone's a villain, and, you know, that's kind of how we simplify those things. But I think the more interesting stories out there are the ones that have a cast of, you know, a multiple cast of individuals who are coming together to focus on a particular thing. So I don't like to think of us as problem solving. So, but, you know, to some degree, that's part of it. But mainly, I think, is to ultimately try to come up with something that's better than just merely the sum of its parts.
Yeah. I think that when you bring people together, you can have a much greater impact on the world than you can when all those people are doing their thing individually. You can have 10 super talented people all doing their job individually.
Yeah.
And then you bring those 10 people together, you know, with Entre Architect, I see it every day in the mastermind groups. Those people in the mastermind groups come together, and together they're more powerful and they get further along than they do individually.
That's the thing, that all you have to do is just remain open and curious about the world. And I can't imagine someone going into this profession knowing the sort of hurdles that one has to have without being open and intellectually curious, fundamentally intellectually curious. I just don't think it works. And if you're not, I would argue that maybe that's the future of architecture isn't really the thing.
Yeah. Well, this is a fascinating conversation. I could keep going forever, but we're going to wrap things up. I want to know your answer to my final question. I have a question that I ask everybody, and this has been a really interesting conversation because you have so many different layers, and we could have a conversation that could last for hours.
You as well, Mark. I mean, so, yeah, sure, that has that in common.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. So my final question is, what is one thing that an architect or a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I would say just be open to, even if it's just community level, just open to what's out there and really try and listen to the people around you. You can become inspired by the most incredible things. And I think if you're really, you have your sort of ear to the railroad tracks, you can usually hear the train come. But the point is, you do have to engage and really, you know, put yourself out there. And when I say community, the community can be just your neighborhood, or if you're really starting out into the localized, well, frankly, now the community is the social media, I think, is a great place for people to expose themselves, and also for other people to learn about the work they're doing. Some of the most interesting things that I see are really the stuff that I'm looking at on my phone. And from people from all over the world who are just curating content. It doesn't even have to be their own content. They're just using their eyes and their voices to essentially help people make connections with places in the world that you never even dreamed existed.
Yeah. I think the struggle in that is that we have to filter out the noise.
Yeah.
Right? Because all those tools have so much information coming through them.
Right.
That your advice to, you know, put your ear to the rail and listen and hear what's coming is a great one, but it takes a lot of intention to do that.
Yeah.
That we can be very easily distracted or overwhelmed with all of the other noise and information that's coming through to us. And so to be intentional and look for those opportunities becomes harder, but makes your life better.
Well, you know, I mean, as a practical suggestion for some of your listeners, especially if you're sort of starting out and you're young, and I do set aside a certain amount of my time to talk to people who want to contact me, you know, I can set up a quick 15-minute call with anybody and walk them through some steps they might be taking to improve their practice. And obviously they can sign up for one of your master classes, and that's an even better thing. But the thing, you never know where your next referral is going to come from. And I would advocate that you really focus on your network of not just clients and former clients, but also your consultants, people that you've worked with, and sometimes even the people who are working with you or for you in your company might themselves have interesting either ways of approaching people or avenues. And so it's a pretty broad net that you have to cast sometimes. But I would say, I think the future in architecture perhaps is allowing yourself some time to step back from those things that you're most focused on and realize that it may not necessarily pay off immediately, but down the road, it's going to reap huge dividends.
His name is Kevin Kennan. He has lots of companies, but the one that you can find him at is Kennan Design Consultancy. The website is kdcaia.com, kdcaia.com. You can also connect with him there and say hi and ask him for 15 minutes of his time. He's available. So, Kevin, thank you for reaching out and connecting with me and your patience. You know, I didn't mention it on the recording here, but we had a little technical difficulty signing on. And so I appreciate you with your patience up front and for all the work that you've done and the impact that you've had on our world. Thank you. And thanks for sharing your knowledge today at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It was a pleasure to be here. And you can just email me at kevin@kdcaia.com. I answer all my emails.
There you go. There's your invitation. Go reach out to Kevin. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Mark.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. with weekly live group business coaching. Yep, we have business coaching there. Monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month. So 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember 3 words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season 1, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.